10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. For this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to, in effect, be stepping into the hallways of a facility that has long vanished from the landscape of Racine. But for the young people who lived there, it was a very important place indeed. And for many of them, it was perhaps a life-saving refuge from the lives they otherwise would have led. I'm talking about the Taylor Home, officially the Taylor Orphan Asylum on the south side of Racine. As a matter of fact, it was located not too far from where my wife and I now live. And the book which I have in hand is written by someone who lived for 6 years in the Taylor Orphan Asylum, or Taylor Orphan Home. His name, David Rozelle. And the book that he has written, which is absolutely beautiful, is called The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree: Flashbacks on a Life Saved by a Children's Home. And one of the most valuable things about this book is that it, in a sense, really helps us to rewrite the assumptions that we might otherwise be led to make about what life would be like in such an orphanage. Because, of course, most of the time, orphanages are depicted in literature or in film or television in the most unsavory sort of fashion, for the most part. And maybe there's a good reason for that. There probably have been all kinds of orphanages in which the children who lived there were maybe not really given the best kind of care. But that most emphatically was not the case with the Taylor Home in Racine. Or certainly that is the perspective of David Rozelle, who has such positive things to say about that home and the people who worked there and its mission to make life as good as possible for the youngsters who found themselves, for one reason or another, living there. And I'm very excited to be able to speak with David Rozelle via telephone about his book, which, by the way, is published by Little Creek Press. Again, the book is called The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree. David Rozelle, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thanks very much for having me on the air, and thanks very, very much for that introduction. I couldn't have written or said it better. Taylor Home did provide me with the best years of my childhood, and my childhood might have been quite different. I might have been flipping the coin on my childhood if my guardians hadn't found Taylor Home for me.
Hmm. I want to make sure that I give credit to a good friend of yours who brought this book to my attention. Tell our listeners about her.
Yes, Leah Richter, as I know her now, Melaine, and I were students together at Whitewater back in the late 50s, early 60s. And Leah and I, let's see, how did this happen? Became reunited. I hadn't talked to her for or exchanged emails with her for 55 years, if you can imagine.
Wow.
That. Yes. So, and I remembered her. Whitewater was a much smaller college than perhaps 1,000 students. And I can recall sitting in some of Leah's classes. So we hadn't talked or communicated for over a half century. And in the Whitewater alumni newsletter recently, there was an announcement that I'd written a book about my years in a children's home. And Leah saw that, and that's how she found the book. So she read the book, and then she emailed me, along with another friend, a close friend of hers who had also been at Whitewater during that time, and now lives in Minnesota. Her name is Rose Brown. So Leah and I began emailing, and she read the book, and she was very excited about it. And I did not know how excited she was, because suddenly she told me that she contacted you, Craig, about the possibility of an interview. So that's how it happened with Leah and me.
Very good. Well, and I have to say that quite often when somebody either eagerly hands me a book which they have written or a book which someone they care about has written, more often than not, it's a book that one way or another is maybe one that doesn't quite live up to its billing, so to speak. This is a case of a book in which I was tremendously impressed with what you had done. You write so beautifully about your experiences at the Taylor home, and you're also, as I said, sharing a story that's really important for us to hear. I wonder if you could tell us if anything in particular prompted you to write this book. I mean, why at this particular point in time, I guess it's a couple of years ago maybe, that you wrote this book. Did anything in particular sort of set the wheels in motion?
Well, I'd been writing this book subconsciously, I suppose, for years, because I was so grateful to Taylor Children's Home, and I would often reminisce about some of my times there, tell others stories. And I was encouraged all along to perhaps write a book someday, but I put that off. And now that I'm growing older, I thought, well, if you're ever going to write a book, it had better be soon. So I began writing the book, and I did it this way. I think this is fairly unusual for a memoir. I had a long piece of paper on a table near my computer, and as flashbacks or memories would come to me, I'd jot down a memory. And pretty soon I had 50 flashbacks, if you can believe that. And from those flashbacks, then, I began writing. And I decided, because memory is so tricky, that most memories don't have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So I wrote vignettes, or what I called flashbacks. Many of the chapters are quite short. One of them takes maybe 2 minutes to read, for instance. So once I began writing recently, that would be 2 years ago, I just became absorbed with providing this account of a children's home that was a tribute to how good institutions can be. And that was one of my purposes. And you pointed that out in your introduction, that that this is, these weren't your words, that this is a tribute to an orphanage, actually an orphanage, when most people have this stereotypical idea of a Dickensian institution where children are treated badly by abusive overseers.
I wonder, you know, this is a book about your experiences at Taylor Home, and you have no reason to know firsthand about the experiences of other children in other orphanages, but I just wonder if you feel like that stereotypical idea that most of us have about orphanages, for the most part, being quite unhappy places, and if there is some basis of truth for that, or do you suppose that that's just largely a fiction that's kind of a convenient fodder for the creation of certain stories, or by and large, are we talking about a lot of orphanages who did not offer the very best of care, and which would make Taylor Home something truly exceptional. Over the years, maybe, have you come to an understanding of the answer to that question?
It's not a certain answer, but I suspect that's the way it was. And I would like to offer a bit of proof that it's part of the history of Taylor Home, if I may. The founder of Taylor Home, Isaac Taylor, was raised in Britain. His parents died early, and he was raised in a sort of orphanage in England, and apparently treated badly. At 18, he made his way to the United States and somehow amassed a fortune. He became a lumber baron and somehow moved to Wisconsin, probably because of its huge forests, and ultimately settled in Racine. As he became older, and as he viewed his wealth, I assume he just decided that he wanted to create an institution that would be better to children than his institution in England was. So he founded Taylor Home virtually on his deathbed, and his wife carried out his wishes. He provided a huge endowment, and he had, I think you'll find this interesting, a criterion for the founding of the home. He insisted, and I think this was in the bylaws when I was there, that the board of directors of Taylor Orphan Asylum always consists of a majority of women. And that's because he was treated so badly by men, and I suspect he saw women as nurturing figures. So I think Taylor Home was exceptional. Now, admittedly, he was raised in Britain, but I suspect these institutions in the United States often failed in their mission to provide sanctuary for children.
You also indicate from time to time that the principles which guided the way in which the children at Taylor Home were cared for seem to have been fairly progressive for their time, in that, for instance, those principles included the notion of children being given a fair amount of freedom, and the opportunities to sort of discover for themselves what their interests and talents might be, or words to that effect, and principles that involved allowing children to enjoy the use of their imagination and so on. Principles that really fly in the face of what we think of as the typical orphanage with ironclad rules and a very institutional feel. Taylor Home seems not to have been like that at all.
It was not. It was, it provided me, as I said, with the best years of my childhood. And much of that had to do with how I was treated. And that included the other children as well. And also the philosophy that seemed to be at work within the institution. What I imagine is that there were meetings conducted by the head of the home, Miss Roskelly, who, in which she reminded everyone of the mission of the home. And that was, as you said, we were provided with so much freedom. Often I tell people today about how on weekends, for example, I could walk down to Taylor and Duran, catch a bus, ride all the way downtown, then go to a movie, come back, ride all the way downtown without an escort, without a guardian, and return to the home. The idea was that they trusted me to do that, and they trusted me to be back at the home in time for dinner, and I always was. So I had this freedom that I don't think children have so much today. In addition, there was an activities director whom I hope I memorialize in the book, Miss Crossfield. Now, there's a name that Charles Dickens would have loved, as I say in the book. Grace Crossfield was her name, and she's the one that encouraged us to be so creative and also at the same time turned us loose. She provided us with activities that encouraged our creativity, and then she would turn us loose on the grounds in the home to pursue whatever creative dreams or activities we chose to pursue. So it was an enlightened, progressive institution, and led by good-hearted women, by the way. Isaac Taylor's dream came true in that respect, that women would be at the center of the mission. And as I said, those were the best years of my childhood. In fact, I have no memory of the time before my entry into the home. My memories begin with my entry into Taylor Orphan Asylum, and then my life took off from there.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with David Rozelle, talking about a lovely memoir called The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree, Flashbacks on a Life Saved by a Children's Home. The children's home in question was officially known as the Taylor Orphan Asylum, an orphanage that used to exist on the south side of Racine. The main structure, at least, of its campus no longer exists. It was torn down in 1972. In fact, at some point in the book, you say something to the effect, yes, dedicated with ceremony in 1872, demolished with none in 1972. So for 100 years, that structure stood, and longtime residents, especially of the south side of Racine, remember it well. Before we get to why you found yourself there, you and your sister Alice, I wonder if we could learn a bit more about the couple responsible for creating Taylor Home, for whom it was named, Isaac Taylor and his wife, Emmerline. You've told us a bit about Isaac's own background, the fact that he grew up in an orphanage that sounds like a bit of a nightmare. But there's more to their story in terms of why they would be so interested in the welfare of children who otherwise would be strangers to them. Tell us more about their life together.
Emmerline and Isaac apparently met in Kentucky, so she was sort of a Kentucky belle, I suppose, fell in love, and then ultimately found their way to Racine. In the meantime, they'd had children, but we must call them a childless couple in that their children had died. So there was that motivation. They were childless, and Isaac was dying, as I said. And I suppose virtually from his deathbed, he and his wife worked out this mission and this financial support for a children's institution in Racine. After Isaac's death, Emmerline then took the lead in carrying out his wishes, and I assume they were her wishes as well, to endow and then have erected this institution. This all began in 1868, plans for the home. I'm sure that was shortly after Isaac's death. And then the home, as you pointed out, opened its doors in 1872. And by chance, I found a steam lithograph in the Waterford Public Library that depicts the home as it opened. The doors aren't open, but there's a wonderful lithograph, a depiction of the home on the cover that I happened to find in Racine County. So in 1872, they began taking children, and that continued until 1972, when the home was demolished. Apparently, it was just too much to maintain. It was a gigantic sort of Victorian mansion-style building, but maintenance became a problem, heating and so on. It consisted of 80 rooms, and I think when I was there, the property consisted of 40 acres on which there was a sort of farm. We raised vegetables, we raised livestock, and the home functioned then as a sanctuary for people like me until 1872, thanks to Isaac and Emmerline Taylor. And I might tell you, there's the possibility that there will be a memorial to both of these wonderful people established on the grounds of the old home. That's in the works, and I can't promise it, but there are hardworking, inspired people in Elmwood and Racine who are hoping to make this dream come true.
One thing I really appreciated about the way you describe the story of what they did is when you describe Isaac's wife, Emmerline, going through the trouble of bringing his wishes to fruition. You write, "His wife, Emmerline, who who died within a year of Isaac in 1866, spent the dwindling months of her life drafting a last will and testament in accordance with her husband's deathbed wishes. And, of course, this means that neither of them lived to see the Taylor home open its doors. But the fact that she would be so devoted to her husband and so devoted to bringing his wishes to full fruition really says something about the two of them and about her.
It does indeed, and I was grateful to have been able to visit their gravesite in Racine. I'd never been there before, and I must say that I was deeply moved by that visit, thanks to a friend from Racine who drove my wife and me out there. Yes, and I think in a way they'll be as alive as long as there are ex-children like me, who have been formed and blessed by their time in the home, and perhaps in their antecedents, their children, grandchildren, great grandchildren, and so on. It was a wonderful place for us, and I, honest to God, don't know what would have happened to many of us. Because many children there, I've learned since writing the book, who have reappeared in my life, had far worse times than I did outside the home. And one of the points I make about the happiness in the home is this. I was happy there, but in the home, in the sanctuary of the home, but whenever the outside world intruded, it seemed that unhappiness followed. I can give you a great example of that. I have, since writing the book, been reunited with two boys who were at the home with me. One, incidentally, became a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. But they had a very hard childhood. And their father would occasionally come out and pick them up at the home for a weekend in their so-called real home. But what happened is this. The boys were so frightened of their father and their stepmother that they would hide when he came to pick them up. And the matrons at the home would have to go out and find them. And then, I suppose, push them into the car, and off they went. And one of them told me that all weekend long, when they were with their parents, they longed to get back to Taylor Children's Home. So that's the most dramatic example I can think of what the home meant to troubled children like those two.
Right.
And they both, as it turned out, became quite successful. As I said, one of them became a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, and the other became a very successful plumber. One still lives in Racine, and the lieutenant colonel is in San Diego and has come back for ceremonies surrounding the book and celebrating Taylor Children's Home.
Wow. In fact, that chapter from which I read an excerpt begins this way: orphans have long memories. But the point you're making at that moment is about Isaac's unhappy experiences. All his life, Isaac Taylor had harbored, for good reason, bitterness against the males who had staffed the Yorkshire poorhouse of his boyhood. The proof lies in his will. And, of course, the fact that he never forgot that terrible treatment was what inspired him to make provisions in his last will and testament for the creation of this orphanage that would be a very, very different place. Something else you say in this chapter I think is really important to highlight. You say that that one of the things that was impressive about this was that it was a large amount of money, $185,000, to purchase this land and create this facility and to have its doors open. But you write, there was more to the will than money. There was extraordinary wisdom. The Taylors had thought it through. Give us a couple more examples of the ways in which they really laid things out in such a way that this orphanage would be the kind of place that they wanted it to be.
Well, I think that, for one thing, it wasn't just a large institutional-like looking building in its time. It was truly beautiful. In fact, I write about how beautiful it was and how astounded I must have been as a boy when I got out of the car and stepped into this, what some people call the mansion. 80 rooms. In addition, it was placed on 40 acres of land so that we had a lot of opportunities to roam, so to speak, and we were turned loose to roam. We weren't put on leashes and attached to a room in the basement. Off we went, and one of the places where we roamed was around the Tarzan tree, what was called the Tarzan tree. Johnny Weissmuller, as Tarzan, was very big in those days, and so the tree became known as his tree, because, as you might remember, he used to swing through the trees and give his yell and loved his life in the jungle. We weren't in the jungle. We were in beautiful Wisconsin landscape, and I think that had a big impact upon us. So the design for the home, 80 rooms, but a beautiful, beautiful building situated in a kind of, at that time, remote area of Racine on a beautiful 40 acres. We went to public school as well, so our educations were very important. The home had a huge library. I think my interest in reading came about because of that library and because of the encouragement of the matrons there. So there was that as well. In addition, many of us needed the security of a schedule. In other words, I can still hear the matrons ringing the bells for breakfast, for lunch, and then for dinner. They would ring them in the hallways, and we'd all head downstairs to the dining room for a breakfast. So we were fed well, and I might mention one of the things that happened to me was when I entered the home, I was malnourished. I was just sort of skin and bones. And the people at the home made sure that I had cream, not milk, but cream on my cereal. So these were really wonderful people, I think, who had already been formed by a sort of mission in their hearts about how children should be treated, but then worked for this home and exercised their mission in addition to the mission that overlay the home.
Hmm. We're speaking with David Rozelle about his memoir, The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree, Flashbacks on a Life Saved by a Children's Home. The children's home referred to in the title, the Taylor Orphan Asylum Orphan's Home on the south side of Racine. For those of you that know the south side of Racine, this facility was located on Taylor Avenue, just south of Durand Avenue. David Rozelle, I don't think we've yet really explored why you and your sister found yourselves at the Taylor home. First of all, just explain the circumstances which, in a sense, brought you to the doorstep of this orphanage back in the summer of 1944.
Yes. My mother was divorced, and I can't remember anything about the time of the divorce because it occurred sometime between the time I was 1 to 5 years old. At any rate, she found herself in desperate straits. And for these reasons, first of all, she found herself with tuberculosis, and so she had to be moved to a sanitarium, and we had to be sort of quarantined away from her. So that was the initial reason for our being placed in the home. But then, and when we entered the home, we thought it would be perhaps, or we were told it might be just 6 months. And after she'd recovered, and then we would be reunited with her. But as you know, in my case, it turned to 6 years. And the reason for that was that my mother was also mentally ill. And tied to that was a developing alcoholism that became a chronic, terrible disability for her. So she tried twice to take us as her children again, but both attempts failed and failed badly, and they didn't last very long. So back to the home we went, and the home welcomed us. So what brought us to the home was the disabilities of my mother, whom, by the way, in writing this book, I have come to forgive. I was angry with her for a long, long time. I didn't understand alcoholism. I didn't understand mental illness. I thought that she had choices, but I'm now convinced she didn't. So if this memorial is ever constructed and the bricks are sold, as that's part of the plan, I will dedicate a brick to Dorothy Roselle, my mother.
Hmm. One of the most touching chapters in the book, and maybe I just want to interject here that this book also has all kinds of terrific humor in it, and we'll touch on some of that as well. But one of the moments in the book that is especially poignant is a chapter called Out on a Ledge, the subtitle, in which some derring do's fails to bring my mother back. You begin the chapter this way. At about age 7, perhaps on 2 or more occasions, I perched on the third-story ledge of Taylor Home and threatened suicide. To my embarrassment, it always came to nothing. The last time I threatened to jump, not a soul screamed, "Oh my God, help! David's going to jump." As a result, within minutes, I crawled back through the open window to resume forever a fulsome life off the ledge. My career as a child extortionist had ended. My mother or my life lacked leverage. A series of disappointments had led me to the ledge. Explain what those disappointments were and just what was going on when you climbed out on that ledge and threatened to jump.
Well, the principal disappointment was what would be called today separation anxiety. I truly loved my mother. I did. And in some of the notes I found by Taylor Home employees about me, someone writes, "We think David misses his mother. We think David worries about his mother." And that was true. Remember, I was only 6, 7, 8 years old. And she would come to visit us occasionally from Milwaukee. She would get on a train. She would hop a bus in Racine, come out to the home, and then we might go to the zoo or a motion picture theater or maybe have lunch somewhere. But then it was time to say goodbye. She would return us to the home. She would encourage us, as she put it, to keep our chins up. And it always hurt. It really hurt. I wanted to be with my mother. And then the panic would set in. And off I would go on these occasions that I point to this third-story ledge in what was called the little boys' department, actually crawl out on the ledge and demand that my mother be returned. And the consequences, if they didn't get her back, would have been for me to sprawl dead at the bottom of Taylor Children's Home. I got over that. I've never gotten over separation anxiety, but I got over that panic about my mother. And there is also a section in the wonderful notes kept by a social worker there who said that David's mother has called him and promised to visit. But David, we suspect, doesn't believe her and just goes on with his life, his play. So my mother's condition is what drove us into the home. And that explains my, I suppose you'd call it, suicidal ideation these days. But I actually don't think I would ever have jumped. The home was my home. And though I didn't have, at that time, the same strong feelings I had for the home that I had for my mother, I knew that a good life awaited me as long as I stayed in the home. And besides, when you're a kid, you know, you don't really analyze this stuff. And I was often operating on impulses, but some of my impulses I've learned were survivor's impulses.
Right. So you entered this home, this orphanage, at the age of 6, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As you entered the home, were you young enough and had your life been, in a sense, isolated enough that you scarcely knew what an orphanage even was? I mean, in a sense, were you shielded from what would have been maybe the horrific expectations of maybe the typical child who would have, you know, read too many horror stories in various works of literature and had really terrible expectations about what kind of life awaited them there? I assume you really walked through the doors of the Taylor home not knowing at all what life was going to be like there.
It's true. I walk through those doors in wonder. And as I point out, in the main hall, that hall I entered that first day, there were portraits of Emmeline and Isaac on opposite walls. And that's my, I guess, my first real memory of the home. And I think I felt comforted because there were some members of my family there. But also, I think that in recollection now, that the matrons of the home, and Miss Roskelly, probably the superintendent, greeted me, and I suppose I was sort of babied because I was a baby. So it was not as traumatic an experience as you might think, and that may be attributed to my ignorance, but also a sort of wonder when I entered this truly magnificent, unusual building.
What about the positive feelings which you obviously have now about really how well cared for you were and all of the children of the Taylor home? Did you feel similarly positive and appreciative? I mean, given the fact that most children don't profoundly appreciate the blessings in their lives as much as they maybe do later on. But at the time, to any significant extent, were you conscious of the fact that you and your sister and all the other children there at Taylor Home were being well cared for?
I can't say that I felt gratitude at that time, but I suppose it's fair to say that I felt nothing consciously, except that I was in this happy place and I adjusted quickly. And to put it simply, I had a bed every night. I knew it would be there. I had a meal every night. I knew that would be there. And I knew there would be activities, and I would be surrounded by friends. These people became my friends. And in a sense, some of them became my brothers, as I've learned since writing the book. By that, I mean that my family, my concept of family to this day, consists of a body of friends. And I owe that to the children's home. Friends are wonderful family, I should tell you, and I learned that at the home. But if you think I might have felt gratitude, I don't recall that, except that, and I will tell you this, I will confess this, when I left the home, I did not want to leave. And I did not go on a ledge, but at least when it came time to go, I did not want to leave Taylor Home, and I really missed it for a period of time when I was placed in my foster home.
I really love the way in which your book reveals all kinds of fascinating little details about daily life at the Taylor home. That, for instance, there was an allowance. And I'm guessing that in many cases, and I'm all but certain it was true for you, this was probably the first time many of you had ever had any money to call your own. Explain how that allowance system worked at Taylor Home and what was required of you in return.
Well, my allowance when I entered Taylor Children's Home consisted of a nickel, and it was always placed in a little brown envelope with my name on the envelope. The presentation of the allowances was ceremonial, actually. It would occur, as I recall, at maybe lunch on Saturday or Friday, and the allowances were presented by name by the superintendent at the home. My first allowances were presented by a woman named Hattie Mills, and she was this kind of lovely older woman with magnificent gray hair, and she would stand up at her table in the dining room, and she would announce our names by turn, and then we'd go up and receive our allowance and probably say thank you, although I don't remember doing that. Then back to the table, I would open my little envelope, and there would be this nickel. And to this day, I can roll a nickel between my index finger and my thumb and just feel like I've got a treasure between my fingers. As one got older, remember I was six when I got my first allowance, the allowance would increase 10 cents, maybe 25 cents, although I don't remember that for this reason. At a certain time, maybe 2 or 3 years after I'd been at the home, I was given the responsibility of gathering the dirty dishes after meals. I would run a cart from the kitchen to the tables and ask shyly the children to pass their plates, and I would put them on the cart and wheel them back into the kitchen. For that, I received 50 cents a week, which was a kingly sum, I must tell you, because it enabled me to catch a bus, round trip, go to the theater in downtown Racine, catch the bus, go home on a Saturday, this would occur, and then on Sunday I could do the same thing. The reason for that is that round trip on a bus cost 6 cents, entry into a theater was 14 cents, that left me 5 cents for a treat, so Saturday would be 25 cents. And Sunday would be the other 25. So, yes, I did have an allowance, and I think I probably spent it pretty responsibly. To this day, I love motion pictures. I saw so many motion pictures I didn't understand, but now I realize were just excellent films.
I like how you now, through the wiser eyes of an adult looking back, have come to really appreciate a lot of the ways in which life at the Taylor home was put together and some of the people who worked there. For instance, I especially appreciate the chapter called Anna and Bertha,
yes,
in which you talk about two formidable looking women who worked in the laundry there at Taylor home. Tell us more about them and why they made such a strong impression on you and presumably the other children.
Well, as it turned out, they were fascinating women. I didn't realize it at the time, but something must have been stirring in my subconscious and in my memory, because when I wrote the book, they really came to life again for me. Anna and Bertha were their names. They did the laundry every day in this huge laundry room in the first story of the building, a sort of basement area. And the reason I remember them is that one would have to walk past their workplace every day, and I remember the smell of the laundry room, the steam, and so on. And then that was the path to the dining room. So we walked by the laundry almost every day. In addition, right across from the laundry, they had a little apartment. That's what it amounted to. They had a huge by Taylor home standards, place where they lived their private lives. Now, Anna and Bertha are a mystery. I don't know anything about them except their first names and their employment at the home. I don't know if they were sisters. I don't know if they were friends, but they were big figures in my life. And as I point out in the book, we might have learned something about the work ethic from Anna and Bertha, because they really slaved in that laundry room. They tended to be sort of disciplinarians, too. It was not a good idea to run in the hall, because they would stop you and sometimes administer a punishment, not a physical punishment, but my sister remembers being frightened one time when they caught her running in the hall and made her kneel in the laundry room for a short time. But they were just powerful figures who did their work every day and were mysteries. But I remembered them, and I remember their little apartments. I never went in there, but I can recall perhaps looking through the window, and it looked like an ordinary apartment. So that's Anna and Bertha.
You describe in some detail about the kind of workload which they faced, washing the laundry of all of the children who lived at Taylor home. And by the way, how many children are we talking about all total who lived there when you were there?
Well, I'm estimating 50 to 60.
Hmm.
There was a little boys' department, a little girls' department. There was big boys, little boys, and there may have been a sort of nursery for younger children. So they had a lot of laundry to do. And I remember always being clean. To this day, I don't mind doing laundry.
Hmm.
I think that had something to do with what was instilled in me W. Taylor Children's Home.
So that you write, week upon week, the stoical pair sorted our sordid laundry into piles and then heaved each load into a monstrous washer that churned and gurgled the dirt away. The next steps weren't any easier. Drying the clothes first required cautiously feeding sodden laundry piece by drowned piece into a factory-strength wringer. Watch your fingers, Bertha. Flattened but still wet, the lifeless clothing got pinched into a heavy metal tumbler for drying. Ironing followed if needed, which entailed feeding wrinkled pieces into the jaws of a mangle for pressing on heated rollers. Unfolded, our clean bedsheets smelled of our laundress's cologne, a blend of singed cotton and bleach. Finally, clean or else, Anna and Bertha folded and stacked each piece by department for distribution upstairs. These were proud working women. Who could blame them for beaming a bit as, red in the face, huffing and puffing, they hand-delivered the fruits of their labor?
Did I write that?
You wrote that.
That's really good. Thank you.
I think so, too. I absolutely think so, too. David Roselle, writing about the Taylor Orphan Asylum on the south side of Racine, where he spent 6 years of his childhood. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll hear more from this interview as David Roselle describes other aspects of life at the Taylor home, including mealtime, and he talks about the stigma which was attached to the children who lived at the Taylor home. David Roselle's memoir is called The Kid Who Climbed the Tarzan Tree, Flashbacks on a Life Saved by a Children's Home. Again, tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will complete this interview with David Roselle, talking about his lovely memoir about his experience growing up at the Taylor Children's Asylum on the south side of Racine. On Thursday's Morning Show, I'm very excited to welcome into our studios John Hambrock. Many of you recognize that name because of the superb comic strip which he is responsible for, called The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. We're going to catch up with John Hambrock and find out about his experience of recently attending the Reuben Awards of the National Cartoonist Society. That would be like the Oscars for the world of cartoonists. John Hambrock on Thursday. On Friday, you'll hear my interview with best-selling author Earl Swift. His most recent book is a fascinating one called Autobiography, in which he comes across a beautiful, well, used to be beautiful, Chevy station wagon from 1957, and in a remarkable bit of sleuthing, is able to solidly connect the lineage of ownership. All 13 owners of that single station wagon, dating all the way back to when it was first purchased back in 1957. It's a fascinating look at recent American history and at our relationship, that is, we as Americans, to our cars. That's on Friday, Autobiography with Earl Swift. The Morning Show is archived at WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Well, after yesterday's weather excitement, today is a absolutely gorgeous day, sunny and warm with a high of 79 degrees inland, a little bit cooler near the lake. Clear and mild overnight with a low of 58 degrees. Sunshine tomorrow morning, partly sunny over the afternoon. A very, very slight chance of a rain shower tomorrow afternoon. We'll warm to a high of 82 degrees, a little bit cooler near the lake. Cloudy on Thursday with a 50-50 chance of rain, high of 73 degrees. It should be sunny for the most part on Friday and Saturday.